From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Basketball fans are caught up in the NCAA college basketball tournaments. On today's Fresh Air, we examine one of the current controversies in college basketball, corrupt recruitment practices. Tim O'Brien doesn't seek out war movies or war novels, but he can't stop himself from telling war stories. His Vietnam novel Going After Cacciato won a National Book Award. Coming up, we talk about his new book of Vietnam stories, The Things They Carried. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Pretty Woman, starring Richard Gere and Julia Roberts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A jury in Alaska today acquitted former Exxon Valdez Captain Joseph Hazelwood of being drunk and reckless in connection with the nation's worst oil spill ever. However, the jury did convict Hazelwood of a misdemeanor charge of the negligent discharge of oil. The misdemeanor charge carries a maximum sentence of 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. Environmentalists were not happy with this afternoon's verdict.
The Environmental Defense Fund is somewhat disappointed with the verdict of Mr. Hazelwood, but we'd still believe that the real trial has yet to begin, and that, of course, is the trial of Exxon Corporation for the oil spill.
Bruce Mannheim is a spokesman for the Environmental Defense Fund. President Bush refused to criticize Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today for demanding Lithuanians turn in their weapons, and Mr. Bush implored both sides in the standoff to continue searching for a peaceful solution. The BBC's Mark Lady reports that today Soviet Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov blamed the Lithuanians for forcing the conflict.
Mr. Gerasimov said President Gorbachev's decree was intended to ensure the rule of law, and he rejected accusations that Moscow was causing increased tension within the republic. There have been unconfirmed reports of some military activity on Lithuania's borders, but Mr. Gerasimov ruled out any use of the military to enforce Mr. Gorbachev's decree. In Lithuania itself, there was some debate over whether to obey the decree ordering the handover of firearms within 7 days. And the head of the local branch of the Soviet military cadet force, General Tarinskas, was criticized for not consulting parliament before handing over the unit's weapons. The Lithuanian leader, Vytautas Landsbergis, is also reported to have said people should give up their weapons if challenged, emphasizing the limited powers the parliament has to enforce its will against Moscow.
Mark Leary reporting from Moscow. The chairman of a key House subcommittee on appropriations, Wisconsin Democrat David Obey, said today that the Bush administration must come up with a new policy in El Salvador or risk losing congressional support. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Congressman Obey's subcommittee on foreign operations must approve all administration requests for foreign assistance, including aid to El Salvador. Today, Obey said he saw no progress in that country, adding that he was tired of, in his words, throwing money down a rat hole.
I frankly do not think that we're making sufficient progress in Salvador, and I personally don't feel that I can vote for Salvador money.
Obey joins a growing number of Democrats who oppose aid to El Salvador. One Democratic proposal is to cut aid by 50% based on a negotiated settlement to end the war there. The aid question comes as one human rights group, America's Watch, issued a report today saying that the overall human rights situation in El Salvador has worsened in the past year. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down more than 32 points at 2695.72. This is NPR. The Idaho Senate passed and sent to the governor today the most restrictive abortion law of any state. If signed by Governor Cecil Andrus, the measure would take effect July 1st. Andrus has not announced whether or not he will sign the measure, but he's reiterated his long-held anti-abortion stand. Today's vote was 25-17 for the measure. The law would make abortion illegal except in cases of non-statutory rape reported within 7 days, incest if the victim is younger than 18, severe fetal deformity, or a threat to the mother's life or physical health. Debate over defending the flag occupied the House of Representatives today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Ever since the Supreme Court declared flag burning a constitutionally protected form of free speech in June, Congress has been caught up in an intensely political debate about how best to protect the flag. This fall, Congress passed a law banning flag burning over the objections of many Republicans and some Democrats who said a constitutional amendment to protect the flag would have been better. Now that law has been challenged and the cases are working their way up to the Supreme Court. The debate today was whether or not the House should press the High Court for an early ruling or wait until its new term in October. Republicans say a move by the Democratic leadership in the House to ask the court to rule in October could leave the flag unprotected until after the elections in November, when some lawmakers hope to make flag protection a big issue. Today, the House passed the Republican resolution calling for earlier Supreme Court review. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Food and Drug Administration today expanded its recall of L-tryptophan to include even small dosages of the dietary supplements. Evidence linking L-tryptophan to a potentially fatal blood disorder led to the initial recall order last November. The disorder, EMS, can cause, among other things, severe muscle pain, fatigue, breathing difficulties, and skin rashes. The expanded recall includes any dosage of the drug. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The college basketball season is climaxing, with the Final Four just a week away. But lately it seems college basketball scandals make the sports pages as often as the game itself. Point shaving, drug use, and the question of whether student-athletes are really students in any meaningful sense. Now there's a new book called Raw Recruits that investigates widespread corruption in college basketball recruiting. The authors are Alexander Wolf, a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and Armin Katayan, a network sports correspondent for ABC News. They say that the amount of money involved in college basketball grew immensely throughout the 80s. CBS and the National Collegiate Athletic Association have just struck a $1 billion deal for TV rights to the NCAA tournament for 7 years. The jackpot from last year's tournament was $1.3 million. And how much each team gets depends on how far they go in the tournament, so the stakes to win are high. This puts a lot of pressure on coaches to recruit the best players. And some coaches and recruiters are using illegitimate practices to acquire the best players. Some go through street agents, third-party middlemen, who Wolf and Katayan call the new curators of the game. I asked Wolf and Katayan to describe this underground recruiting system.
Well, part of it is that recruiting has become a summer activity. It used to take place during the school year when there was a structured situation, when the high school coach, the guidance counselors were all on the scene. Now there are these summer leagues, AAU tournaments, and so forth, and that is where the street agents interpose themselves. They tend to show up in inner-city situations where there may not be a father figure in a family, a single-parent home, a youngster looking for guidance. A gentleman will come into the scene. He'll be offering a free pair of sneakers every now and then, perhaps a dinner, take a youngster out to an NBA game. And by the time a youngster hits 9th or 10th grade, and remember in basketball you can tell at a very early age when a youngster will blossom into a great player, the kid is suddenly beholden to this person, and maybe even unbeknownst to this youngster, this third party is perhaps cutting a deal with a college, oftentimes channeling him to a high school. And it's not a symbiotic relationship at all. It's a very parasitic one.
What does the street agent get once they get the loyalty of the player?
Sometimes it may be an ego rub, nothing more than that. Sometimes they're looking for something from a college down the road to be a part of the program, to get a kickback of some sort. We found an instance where a street agent asked a college coach for $15,000 in exchange for a youngster, with the stipulation being that that money would be used to get the kid, quote, hooked up for school, unquote, that is, get him clothes and a car and spending money. And down the road, if the youngster does pan out and becomes a pro player, that street agent is going to want to become a legitimate agent, that is, represent him in pro contract negotiations.
And a lot of times, too, Terry, what happens is these guys are, they're aware that the money that's being made by these million-dollar basketball programs. They want cash. In Los Angeles, for example, where we did a lot of reporting, they want shoes for their summer league program. They want travel money so their summer league team can travel to the big tournaments in Las Vegas or in Phoenix or in Texas. So it's $500 here, $1,000 there, a dozen shoes, maybe some bags. But when you're dealing with 8th or 9th or 10th grade kids, those are fairly high stakes, and it all adds up to influence, which is one of the big themes we have in the book.
Well, you suggest that there might even be a certain amount of blackmail going on in the summer leagues, for instance, of saying to a recruiter, give something to my league or else I'm not going to recommend my best players to you.
Absolutely. There's a number of instances. We talked to Terry Kirkpatrick, who was a Houston assistant coach who put together in large part the Phi Slamma Jamma team that was involved in the Final Fours at Houston. A number of assistant coaches have told us that it is sort of a blackmail situation. You want access to the player. You want to know his home phone number. You want to know where he's going to be during a certain recruiting period. You've got to cough up something. A lot of times it's cash. Sometimes it's product, shoe product, which the schools, it really doesn't bother them because they're getting an endless supply of shoes and equipment from the Nikes and the Reeboks of the world. So as we talk, it's really a process that works from the bottom up. The kids are in eighth grade or seventh grade, are corrupted, and by the time they get to the time they're being recruited by the colleges, they have their hands out, and they're not looking for a travel schedule or a free scholarship. They want the big bucks.
My guests are Alexander Wolf and Armin Katayan. They're the authors of the new book, Roar Recruits, and it's about recruiting and corruption in college basketball. Now let's talk about the role of the shoe companies, the sneaker companies in college basketball now. As you were saying that the shoe companies fund some of the summer leagues, you say that the shoe companies also fund a lot of college basketball in the sense that a lot of the coaches have become paid consultants to the big sneaker companies.
That's correct. Nike is a classic example. And what they've done is at the very low levels of the game, with 6th, 7th, and 8th grade summer leagues, they will fund the league. At the higher levels of high school basketball, they take the 120 best high school kids, bring them together in Princeton, New Jersey each summer for a week-long camp. They do a lot of salutary things there. They teach them study skills and so forth. But they also ply them with product, again, shoes, sweatsuits, and so forth. And in this context where there are Nike coaches, that is, coaches like Georgetown's John Thompson gets $200,000 a year, and most of the other big-name programs are also sponsored by Nike, where Nike gives up to 75 pair of free shoes a year to some of the top high school programs, particularly in inner-city areas. And many of those high school programs are suspected of channeling shoes to junior high kids to use as inducements to get the junior high kids into those high schools. It's kind of a vertically integrated system where in, say, sixth grade, a kid gets weaned onto Nikes. And you know how youngsters are with brand loyalty. Nike is hot now, Spike Lee, Michael Jordan and all. And
they're doing TV endorsements.
Exactly. Right? They're doing TV endorsements, and they see the Georgetown Hoyas, which certainly in the inner cities is the flagship team, see everyone on Georgetown wearing Nikes. A youngster gets fixated on this brand, and obviously Nike hopes that the next Michael Jordan through the late 90s will be their main spokesman. And it's like harvesting crops. If you get kids, plant the seeds with sixth graders, you sort of cultivate these kids right on through the next six, seven, eight grades. Ultimately, you can harvest the superstar when it's time to go pro.
We do, I think, a very detailed and fairly fascinating profile of Sonny Vaccaro, who is the Nike promotions wizard who has really masterminded Nike's influence in college basketball. Nike's budget is about $3.5 million a year that they funnel into college basketball at all levels. And what Sonny has done is that everywhere you turn in college basketball, there's Nike. And everywhere you turn in high school basketball, there's Nike. Now everywhere you turn in grade school and junior high school basketball, particularly in the urban markets or the inner city markets, there's Nike. He himself admits that he's bought a sport from top to bottom. And where he has the real questions, I guess the ethical questions, is this right? Should Nike have this influence? The answer often is that there are no rules governing by the NCAA or by the coaches or by the National High School Federations or by the AAU organization, which prohibits Nike's influence at this point in time. So they're really running sort of roughshod over the entire structure of college and high school and junior high school basketball with really without any sort of punitive measures being put in.
What's wrong with a shoe company trying to cultivate loyalty by giving sneakers to a team?
Well, there's nothing on the surface wrong with it at all. It's if unbeknownst to the youngster, this process becomes kind of a way to conscript him into an army, and you know his length of service is going to last 6, 7, 8 years. When you're 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, you don't really realize what's going on, and you get this sort of irrational brand loyalty into your head, as so many young people do. We had a youngster named Tony Farmer, who now is at Nebraska, told us flat out that he would not even consider playing at a non-Nike school. Now, if Nike is able to cut deals with coaches and provide free product that is used as leverage to get kids to make decisions, it's an incredible recruiting advantage. And we had coaches tell us who are signed by Converse and Reebok that it is a disadvantage to not be a Nike coach today.
It's almost like brainwashing, where the kids feel the first effects of the shoe company's power at a very early age, and as time goes on, they become more and more attached to the product. And it's sort of insidious in a way, because the product is never ending, and with product, it relates in the inner city to status.
I want to get back to the consultancies that many of the coaches have with the shoe companies. You suggest, I think, that the reason why the money is given to the coaches and the free sneakers are given to the coaches is that the companies can't give it directly to the athletes themselves because the athletes are officially amateurs.
Exactly. NCAA rules are very strict on that point. The kids can't get a penny. And John Thompson gets $200,000 a year from Nike. Jerry Tarkanian gets $120,000 a year from Nike. Not because they're filling out the occasional questionnaire about product or making a few appearances at clinics, but because their players will be wearing these shoes and will sail in for a dunk perhaps on the cover of a national magazine or show up on TV in those shoes. It's almost as if the players are Trojan horses who kind of smuggle the trademark into the national media. And one of the things that the kids aren't dumb. They realize what's going on. They see this incredible endorsement money the coaches get. Nike pays Thompson perhaps three times as much as Georgetown pays Thompson. Who does John Thompson actually work for? And the kids see that, and I think they're smart enough to be bothered by it. And this attitude of entitlement that has been cultivated from the lowest levels of the summer league reaches a point where they say, hey, where's mine?
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guests are journalist Alexander Wolf and Armin Katayan, and they're the authors of the new book, Roar Recruits, that's an investigation into college basketball recruiting practices. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about college basketball recruiting. My guest, Alexander Wolf, writes for Sports Illustrated, and Armin Katayan is a sports correspondent for ABC News. What are some of the special deals that college recruiters now offer players to join their team?
Well, we found cash, of course, to be the time-honored and most hallowed of inducements. Cars, an off-campus apartment, rather than having to live in the tenement of a college dorm is also very popular. There's currently an allegation, the NCAA is investigating the University of Illinois and their practices, and I know one of the allegations in that case at the moment is that an automatic teller card was offered to induce prospects to go to the University of Illinois, which would take cheating to an entirely new high-tech level. The fact is that inducements have been around for years, and Wilt Chamberlain, when he came out of Kansas in the 50s, said that he had received $20,000 to attend school there. Now, in the 50s, the stakes for college basketball were minimal, and you can only imagine if we've gone from minimal stakes in the 50s and a Chamberlain is worth $20,000 to what the stakes today are worth. The NCAA has not changed its rules in the slightest. You're still only entitled to a scholarship, books, room, board, tuition. And I think that is probably the most persistent inequity in the whole system. And one of the things that the players immediately realize is that chasm between reality and the rules. You know, the other thing that's interesting is that the NCAA seems to have made a conscious decision not to do anything about this, in spite of, through the 80s, the amount of money that they're generating from the tournament, from the TV rights. They have held relatively steady the number of enforcement staff they've devoted to trying to clean up the game. The enforcement department has a budget of only $2 million, this despite an average of $143 million that will be flowing into the NCA each year with this new television contract. The people who work in the enforcement division get starting salaries in the low 20s. They tend to be very inexperienced, recent law school graduates. There's high turnover. The party line out of the NCA is that they're getting a handle on cleaning up the game. But in fact, I think that's really a very sunny spin they're putting on things. They have addressed the problem of selective enforcement. There was for a long time a feeling that the very high-profile programs that generated the most revenue for the NCA would be immune from any sort of investigation. They've done something. They investigated Kentucky, which is the most traditional and hallowed program in the game, and put them on probation recently. But I think other than addressing that problem of selective or perceived selective prosecution, the NCAA Enforcement Division is ill-equipped to handle what's happening today, particularly at these lower levels where they really have no jurisdiction in the street corners and the playgrounds.
And they really don't – I'm sorry, Terry. They really don't have any idea. I think our book has opened the eyes of the NCAA. I know that one of the investigators has read it a couple of different times looking at things, and they really don't understand how the whole process works. And I think the book has opened their eyes to the street-level game and to how the whole system of corruption begins from the ground up.
What other suggestions for reform do you have? I know you think that some rethinking is needed on how the money from college basketball is divided. What suggestions do you have?
Well, if we took the $1 billion over the next 7 years and distributed it in equal shares to the 292 Division I schools that are playing basketball, regardless of whether they qualify for the tournament or not, only 64 teams qualify each year. If we did that, it would be a step in the right direction. It would be a strong statement to all the schools that there will be no correlation between how many games you win and how much money you will receive. What's most interesting is how much in favor of that idea, this sort of Swedish socialism model, the coaches are. They're absolutely in favor of that. The outgoing head of the Coaches Association, Judd Heathcote, has proposed that. It's because an athletic director sees the millions being made in the tournament, wants a part of that, budgets at the beginning of the year into his budget a line item for a tournament share, and of course, if the team doesn't make the tournament, who feels the pressure? The head coach. Where does he pass the pressure on? To his assistants, who do the recruiting, who work on one-year contracts most of the time. And if that pressure is being put on their shoulders, that's where your abuses are going to start.
Has the kind of corruption that you've written about ruined the pleasure of the game for you?
I will say immediately no. And it's because of college basketball. It has in it the highest highs when it's high. And I think we saw it last week during the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament, just the way the Loyola Marymount kids played in honor of Hank Gathers, their teammate who died when his heart stopped recently. They just played with such joy and such purpose. I had the privilege of covering the Ohio Valley Conference tournament a couple of weeks ago, a little town in western Kentucky called Murray. Only one team from that conference was going to go to the NCAA tournament, the team that won this postseason tournament, and everything was on the line. It was an old gym with rafters in it, and to get there you had to drive 2 hours from the nearest airport, and you had to swerve around the roadkill. And it was like going back in time, and the games were just tremendous. The best player in the tournament had a nickname called Popeye, and it just reminded me, in the midst of all this unhappiness, that this is basically kids who just love the game, and at its best, there is nothing better. At its worst, there's probably nothing worse.
I agree with Alex, and I think it's very well said. You look at it from afar, and it's really a beautiful game to watch. There's the poetry on the court, and there's the emotion and the drama and the excitement that I think is unmatched in either college or professional sports. It's my favorite event to watch. But when you look at it from the inside, it's more disheartening, I think, and saddening in a way to see what's happened to the sport. And the reasons why Alex and I wrote this book and spent a lot of time talking to the coaches within the sport who, in many cases, poured their hearts out to us and said, you know, it's got to be changed. Things have to change in order for this sport to survive, or it's going to go over the cliff. That's the reason why we did it. We didn't do it to stick holes in it or poke fun at it or to sensationalize anything. What we wanted to do was give the viewer an inside view of what it's like within the sport, the turmoil in the, within the sport, the system with that in which these great players find their way to the court, and in hopes that in enlightenment and educational enlightenment that change will be affected, that things will change even in a small way.
Armin Katayan and Alexander Wolf's new book is titled Raw Recruits. Katayan is a sports correspondent for ABC News, and Wolf is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. I called the National Collegiate Athletic Association and spoke with Dave Burst, the assistant director for enforcement. He disagrees with many of the allegations in the book Raw Recruits. Burst feels that the enforcement division of the NCAA is adequately staffed. As for colleges cutting deals with players that go beyond what the regulations allow, Burst says it doesn't go on as much as the public thinks. And he said it's difficult to track down street agents because they work surreptitiously in back rooms. There are no NCAA regulations on shoe company endorsements, but Burst said that's an issue the NCAA will probably discuss in the near future. I asked David Burst what tools the NCAA Enforcement Division could use to become more effective.
We don't have subpoena power or the kinds of abilities that the courts would have or that law enforcement officials would have. We have to rely on cooperation and run out a lot of bad stories, and that's difficult to do if you don't have subpoena power to either cause people to testify under the threat of perjury or the ability to develop documents even when someone doesn't want to cooperate with you.
What kind of changes, if any, do you think the NCAA needs to make in its policies to uphold the integrity of college basketball?
Well, I don't think that issue of integrity comes as a result of the thickness of the NCAA manual or even of from the efforts of the staff that I work with to enforce regulations. Integrity comes from the institution itself and from the individuals that are associated with those programs. And I think what we're seeing in the recent past and I hope near future is efforts by chief executive officers to get involved in athletics programs and to understand what's going on in those programs, and efforts to treat the ills before the NCAA enforcement staff has to get involved. If we can support those kinds of efforts and get support, I think, even from the public to demand higher standards of conduct by people who are dealing with young athletes, then it seems to me we have a chance for the future.
David Burst, the Assistant Director for Enforcement for the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Earlier, I spoke with Armin Katayan and Alexander Wolf, authors of the new book, Roar Recruits. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Bob Kane, the creator of Batman. He drew Batman comics from 1939 to 1966. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Tim O'Brien says he's not obsessed with the Vietnam War, but he is obsessed with soldiers' stories about Vietnam. Those stories inspired O'Brien's novel Going After Cacciato, which won a National Book Award. And they were the inspiration for his new book, The Things They Carried. Coming up, Tim O'Brien tells us what he carried while he was a soldier in Vietnam. Also, film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new comedy Pretty Woman, starring Richard Gere and Julia Roberts as a couple brought together by love and money. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Anchorage, Alaska, the former skipper of the Exxon Valdez, Joseph Hazelwood, has been acquitted of being drunk and reckless in connection with the nation's worst oil spill, and convicted of a minor charge of negligent discharge of oil. This occurred when the tanker ran aground and spilled nearly 11 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound a year ago. He faces up to 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. In Washington, President Bush today repeated his call for peaceful talks between officials in Lithuania and the Kremlin. The president spoke during an impromptu news conference after a tree planting ceremony on the White House grounds. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Mr. Bush refused to condemn Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev for demanding Lithuanian citizens turn in their guns. He called for peaceful resolution of the problems between the two sides and for calm negotiation and discussion. And he restated past American policy regarding Lithuania.
We do not recognize the incorporation of Lithuania into the Soviet Union. However, there are certain realities in life. The Lithuanians are well aware of them, and they should talk as they are with the Soviet officials about these differences.
The president began his news conference with an appeal to Congress to quickly approve his $800 million aid package for Panama and Nicaragua. Mr. Bush, however, was unable to answer whether he supported U.S. aid for the African National Congress in South Africa, as ANC leader Nelson Mandela is seeking. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Tanks and troops kept rival protesters apart in the Transylvania area of Romania today, and efforts continued to try and defuse the country's worst ethnic violence since World War II. The situation is now causing tension between Romania and Hungary. Misha Glenny of the BBC reports from Budapest.
Speaking at a news conference given by the leaders of the Socialist Party, Hungarian Foreign Minister Mr. Gyula Horn said that in the past few days, Romanians had unleashed pogroms, as he put it, against not only Hungarians in Transylvania, but against Gypsies and Jews as well. He warned that this could spread to the whole country and might result in civil war. Mr. Horn accused the Romanian government of not responding to requests to open talks on the matter. The plight of the Hungarian minority in Transylvania is now having a clear effect on the Hungarian election campaign, which ends on Sunday, when Hungarians go to the polls for the first pre-elections here in over 40 years. All the major parties have condemned the violence in Transylvania, but they have scrupulously avoided using the conflict as a way of gaining votes.
Misha Glenny of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 32 points to close at 2,695. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's nothing unusual these days about seeing the Vietnam War depicted in movies, television, and books. But back when the subject of Vietnam was considered too risky, my guest, novelist Tim O'Brien, was writing about the war. He served in Vietnam in 1968 as an infantryman. In 1973, he published his first book, a memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone. In 1979, his novel Going After Cacciato became the surprise winner of a National Book Award, beating out John Irving's The World According to Garp and John Cheever's Stories. Cacciato was about a soldier who decides he's had enough of the war and takes off for Paris. The novel mixed poetic realism and comic fantasy. O'Brien's new book is The Things They Carried, a collection of Vietnam stories tied together by a fictional narrator whose name is also Tim O'Brien. I asked O'Brien to read from the book In this passage, the narrator is reading a 17-page disjointed letter in which his former combat buddy writes about the problem of finding a meaningful life after the war.
I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him, how it brought back all kinds of memories, the Vills and Paddies and Rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that shithole. A guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. The guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't find any words, if you know what I mean, and I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the field that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it.
Has anything like that actually ever happened to you, getting a letter from a friend or having a friend say to you, you've got to tell my story, I can't do it, but you've got to tell it?
Oh, it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times. I've never taken them up on the offer, and even in this case I didn't. The letter is made up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people almost define themselves by maybe a half dozen or a dozen stories that describe the pivotal incidents in their life?
I do. In my own life, you know, I would say there are a handful, maybe a dozen incidents that are like touchstones that recur over and over in my fiction. There's one incident in the book, in my new book, about the shooting of a baby water buffalo in Vietnam. And the image of a defenseless water buffalo being shot over and over and over again is one that has appeared in, I think, everything I've written, or close to everything I've written. I'm not sure, you know, what the image is there for in terms of symbol or metaphor. Probably nothing. It just has the feel of meat, which was the feel of war. Flesh and blood. Poor baby buffalo being shot over and over and over again. That's a senseless, you know, that's war.
Well, in the novel, the person who's shooting the water buffalo is doing it after he's seen a friend of his die, you know.
Yes.
one of his buddies die, and this is interpreted as a kind of not exactly revenge, but venting, some kind of venting of the frustration. Did you witness something like this? Is that why the image keeps recurring in your fiction?
Yeah, I did. I witnessed, we were walking along a paddy dike one day after a few hours in a village adjacent to the village of My Lai where the massacre happened. We lost several fellows who'd hit landmines. And the platoon was lined up in a long, long row across the paddy dike, and 100 yards away stood a water buffalo. And with no signal, the men began firing, and the buffalo stood there, and you could see gobs of flesh, you know, jumping off the beast. And it stuck.
Were you one of the men who fired?
No. I watched, dumbly. I understood it. You can't justify something like that, but there was no enemy to take it out on. Men were feeling sorrow and rage simultaneously, and the buffalo was there to bear the brunt.
Although the narrator in your new novel, The Things They Carried, has the same name as you do, Tim O'Brien, you make it really clear in subtle ways throughout the book that this narrator is not really you, although you've given him your name. So you're always kind of challenging the reader to say, hey, make this connection between me and the narrator, but keep in mind the narrator isn't me at all. Why are you playing with us like that?
I love to play. Fiction should be fun. The idea came to me in an hour or so at the typewriter. Instead of calling my protagonist Ernie or Fred, I typed the word Tim down. And it seemed that this had the possibility, at least, to be fun. Beyond that, it pushed me down inside myself. Although the events in the book are invented, the emotions and the passions of the book are from my heart. And by typing sentences with the word Tim in them, I found myself going down deeper and deeper and deeper into my memories of Vietnam, and coming up with a lot more. This book is the first book I've ever written that seems to me to touch my own heart, and I hope, you know, it'll touch the reader's heart too.
I'm surprised to hear you say it's the first book that's touched your own heart. I mean, your first book was a war memoir. Your second book, the novel Going After Cacciato, was set in Vietnam, and I'm sure that there was a lot of stuff based on your own emotions and memories from the war. Why does this one feel like the first one that really came from the heart?
I think partly because of the use of my own name. Cacciato, although it's my, you know, my best-known work and best-liked work to date, feels to me a little cerebral. I'm playing in that book with memory and imagination, basically the things I'm writing about in my new book. But the form of the book, of Cacciato, that is, has an intellectual feel to it, like artifice. Whereas the new one, the stories are simple, tender, I hope. And there's just a quality of, I read these things aloud as I do at colleges now, and then my voice sometimes it cracks a little. I don't know how to explain it. I just feel it.
Tim O'Brien is my guest. His new novel is called The Things They Carried. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tim O'Brien is my guest. His first novel, Going After Cacciato, like his new book, was about the war in Vietnam. O'Brien served in Vietnam in 1968. Are you as absorbed in the war in actual life as you are in your fiction?
Not at all. Not at all. The war was 20 years old for me. I don't dream about the war. I never have. I don't think about it. The war comes to me only as material for storytelling. I'm obsessed not by Vietnam, not by war, but I'm obsessed by these stories, some of which, you know, I've heard, some of which I invent. But it's the story that intrigues me, and the trying to actualize the story through some decent writing.
How vivid are your memories from the war? I mean, how much do you think you remember of, what, the year that you were there?
Oh, a few scattered images. The way if you were to pick up a photographic album and page through it, you'd maybe 7 or 8 pictures would be, you know, there that would be really vivid, another 24 or so you'd vaguely recollect. And the rest of the album is empty. A lot of black pages, which you'd expect, I think, that our memories leave us. But beyond that, a lot of the war was not memorable. Plodding along from village to village, hot days, mosquitoes. It was a kind of monotony to it, but a strange monotony, you know, with boredom with a twist.
What was the twist?
The twist was a kind of, like a leaky faucet in your stomach, and instead of water, there was this acid feeling dropping out where you can feel it just eating away inside you. You're bored and frightened simultaneously. Try it sometime. It's tough.
Let me ask you about a couple of the images in the book and see where they come from in actuality or your imagination. I mean, what they signify to you. One of the men in the company, Henry Dobbins, is always wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his head. It's his protective magic, his good luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of the men you know have something like that? Did you have anything like that yourself?
No, I didn't carry pantyhose, but it, there were talismans that had been carried in war, and the kind of talismans that touch on peace. That the pantyhose business is wrapped around a fellow's neck as a kind of comforter, is a reminder of all that he doesn't have, his girlfriend, and the peace that that girl represents for him. And some men carried letters from home. Some men carried coins their father made and sent them. A lot of us carried photographs. Some carried lockets of hair.
What were the things that you carried with you to remind you of who you were and what it was that you loved?
I carried odd things. I carried a book of German grammar. I wanted to learn German while I was in Vietnam.
It seems like such a remote thing.
What an odd thing to be saying, you're Spanish, sprechen Sie Deutsch, and trying to get the accents right and learn the grammatical structures of German after marching all day long through really horrible things. It was a way of, it was a lot of us pushing the war aside, if even for a few moments.
Well, I guess it was also a way of affirming that you had a life of the mind, that there was more besides your body in the war.
Yeah, I think that was a great, great part of it, and a way of just touching on civility and civilization, which for me books represented then and continue to represent. I mean, that's what they are.
What else did you carry?
Oh, gee, I carried so much. I carried cans of orange juice that my father had sent me from Minnesota. These were just precious to me. He sent me 12 cans, and they were heavy. And it wasn't the orange juice I craved. It was the fact that these cans of orange juice had come from my dad from so far away. And I gave myself 1 month for each can. One can a month.
So you measured your whole tour of duty by those cans?
By those cans of orange juice.
Did you ever try to travel light?
Yeah, I mean, eventually you have to. You discard things. You discard odd things as a soldier. You discard things like hand grenades and belts of ammunition, the things you think you'd keep, claymore mines. We were so burdened by stuff that we were like giants lumbering through that countryside, hauling along with us the whole, all those resources of the American war chest.
Your first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, was really one of the early war memoirs. When did it first come out? Was it 1973?
Yes.
And then Going After Caciato came out a few years later. It was still one of the early Vietnam novels. Was it different for you writing about the war before Vietnam had so penetrated fiction, movies, and television?
I can't say that the output of recent books and movies and so on about the war has helped me or hindered me. I haven't seen many of the movies, and I haven't read many of the books.
I'm surprised to hear that. You'd be curious either to see what other people were doing with it, or to see if how it compared to your own experiences or your own telling of the experiences.
For me at least, I'm not much interested in war stories. Most of them tend to be melodramatic and predictable and bad stories. And I think a lot of readers feel the same. We've been brought up in too many John Wayne movies and too much bad writing. This isn't true just for Vietnam, of course. It's true for if you look at love stories, look at all those Harlequin romances out there. But nonetheless, there's something about the war story that makes me want to turn my head and move away gently. For me, the war is, that isn't important to me now. What's important to me is language about the war and about the human heart. I was never a very good soldier. I hated that war. And it's now in the distant past. What's in the present for me are the stories that have really, in a way, nothing to do with the war. They're set in the war, but they're stories for me of friendships and ghosts and girlfriends and that kind of thing.
Another image I want to ask you about, and I wasn't sure whether this was literary or actual.
<All right. laughs>
there's a sequence, and it's a pretty pivotal sequence where a couple of the characters in your novel are in a field of sewage. Mm-hmm. And the smell just won't go away. I mean, long after they've left, the smell just won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's the literary image there is clear. I was wondering if that was an actual experience too, if there were fields of sewage like this that you got caught in.
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be a description of actual things and not as metaphor, not as symbol. Just stuff.
I'm really
stuff.
Glad to hear that, by the way.
It was shocking to read it, you know, in some column or review that. You know, this is taken as a metaphor for something. It didn't occur to me. I mean, as soon as it was written, I thought, oh, my God, you know, I can see it. But it was intended just as stuff, a field full of sewage that we camped in one night. And we were attacked and mortared, and a man went under.
Man went under the sewage?
Yeah, no metaphor, just under.
I'd like to try to explain why it is that I'm almost relieved that it really happened. Do you know what I mean? As something that really happened, it seems quite horrible. As something that would have been metaphor, it would seem like too much.
Yeah, it would have. You know, in a way, it's one of those things where, you know, if I would have, I suppose, thought a little more clearly about it all, I might have avoided it. But, I mean, what would I do? How would I change things? I probably wouldn't in the long run. I think if Melville, in writing Moby Dick, thought that whale would be finally just a metaphor, he might have changed it to a tuna fish. Not quite so godlike.
How long did it take before you could wash the sewage off and get out of there?
I never have. It's that smell is still in my dreams. It's the one thing that's really stuck with me. I don't dream Vietnam, but the smell, I don't know if you've ever had an operation that had ether.
Yes,
I did,
yeah.
As a kid.
My tonsils, getting my tonsils out.
That, you know, that now and then, every 3 years or 8 years, the smell of ether returns to me. It's not set in the hospital, but that's a folding feeling in the brain, just a folding over the brain with a smell inside the folds. And that's what returns to me now and then, the smell of that field of sewage folding through my dreams.
What do you think it is that it's the smell that stays with you more than anything else?
That was a pretty terrible smell.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. And part of it is, you know, I'm sure it was linked somehow to the awful thing that happened in the field that night.
Tim O'Brien's new book, The Things They Carried, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from the Soviet Union on the quite uneasy situation in the Republic of Lithuania, which has declared its independence from Moscow. We'll talk with a BBC reporter in the Transylvania region of Romania about the violence and growing distrust there between Romanians and the ethnic Hungarian minority. Also, letters from listeners and the story of $20 million worth of rare books stolen and found in a house in Autumna, Iowa. Also, the music of Eric Bogle. He's from a small town in Scotland. He moved to Australia many years ago, and he turned into a world-class folk singer.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pretty Woman is the new film by director Gary Marshall. He also made last year's Bette Midler movie Beaches, The Flamingo Kid, and Nothing in Common. Pretty Woman stars Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. Laura San Giacomo from the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape also has a small role. Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman has this review.
In today's entertainment biz, we love it when shallow, good-looking actors prove they have some character. We applaud when Rob Lowe goes on national TV to confess his sexual sins. We honor Tom Cruise with awards and Oscar nominations for becoming a serious actor, even if he isn't very good at it. And we love it when actresses who are cast for their sexiness reveal a little bit of talent as well. It makes us feel more honorable for liking them. This last item accounts for the tremendous praise lavished on sexpots like Kim Basinger and Meg Ryan. The latest candidate to be rescued from bimbohood is Julia Roberts, the modestly likable and very sexy star of the plastic screwball comedy Pretty Woman. Roberts is a ravishingly beautiful actress, but she's not beautiful in the way that movie stars are. Despite the wide, wax-lipped smile she shares with her brother Eric, her face has a Vogue cover girl anonymity, and so does her acting. In Pretty Woman, she plays a Los Angeles prostitute who's rescued from squalor by a cold-hearted corporate raider, played by Richard Gere. He picks her up on Hollywood Boulevard, takes her to his hotel, and proposes an unconventional arrangement.
Vivian, I have a business proposition for you.
What do you want?
I'm going to be in town until Sunday. I'd like you to spend the week with me.
Really?
Yes. Yes, I'd like to hire you as an employee. Would you consider spending the week with me? I will pay you to be at my beck and call.
Look, I'd love to be your beck and call girl, but you're a rich, good-looking guy. You could get a million girls free.
I want a professional. I don't need any romantic hassles this week.
If you're talking 24 hours a day, it's gonna cost you.
That's exactly the sort of glum, rhythmless patter that makes Pretty Woman so tiresome. Roberts and Gere are meant to be a gloss on the characters from Pygmalion and all those wisecracking couples from 40s comedies. But Gere sounds practically sedated, and Roberts delivers her lines casually without the requisite comic spin. Not that William Powell and Myrna Loy could have done a whole lot with this script. As Pretty Woman goes on, the two characters tease, taunt, and circle each other, trying to decide whether they have a relationship or a business transaction. By the end, Roberts has taught Gere that some things, like, you know, feelings, just can't be bought. And he's shown her a thing or two about class. These are the kinds of characters who exist nowhere but in the minds of callow Hollywood screenwriters. Still, the movie has a real chance of catching on. With its tough hooker heroine, it can play as a feminist version of an upscale Cinderella fantasy. Pretty Woman pretends to be about how love transcends money, but the movie is obsessed with status symbols, much like the video for Paula Abdul's The Way That You Love Me. It's really saying that the Roberts character becomes a better person when she lands a rich guy and learns to cry at the opera. Pretty Woman is the kind of film that doesn't just pander to its audience, it puts the moves on you.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the creator of Batman Comics, Bob Kane. And filmmaker John McNaughton tells us about his disturbing film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. He describes it as too bloody for the art crowd, too arty for the blood crowd. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.